Okay, good morning, everyone. Good morning. When I look at a room, I kind of judge the room. I'm thinking, these guys are committed to being in the session. The guys right on the edge are thinking, oh, maybe I'll leave halfway. Depends how rude he is to me. I guess I should warn you, I might be rude to you. I'm going to take you a little bit outside your comfort zone. How many people here are developers? Okay, most of you, yeah, we're in the right room then. This is good. This is a good start. I'm in the right room too, which is also good. How many people here are doing kind of what they would consider to be agile development? Maybe half a bit more, okay. I don't know what agile means anymore, by the way, so you guys make it up. You're probably all doing something that's a bit agile. Some of you are probably not doing anything agile. Those are the ones that didn't put their hands up when I said if you're a developer or not. But. So the title of this talk is You Know Nothing Until You Ship. And I guess what I think about when I think about this question or this statement is, how much do you really know? And you know, to some degree, I'm being, you know, trying to push you straight away outside your comfort zone when I'm saying this, because of course, I know that you all know everything. You're actually, every individual one of you is the smartest person in your company. Even if there's two of you from the same company here, each of you is the smartest person in the company. So, you know, when I ask this, when I make this statement, I'm thinking of a few things, and I always like to start with taking a step back and thinking, why do I make these statements? Why am I so obnoxious? Why am I such an asshole? Why do I say you know nothing until you ship? Well, the first thing is, why should you care? Why should you care about what you know? And then why do you know nothing? And I will explore this a little bit in the first 10 minutes, and then we'll dig into some things that you can do that are activities that will help you know more. And why don't you know more? And we'll talk about why you actually don't know more, and why shipping will help you know more, and how you get to that point. So I love graphs. They never really mean anything, but here is a graph I made up with some numbers I made up. So out of 10, when you start a project, most people think they know everything there is to know about. I've got this great idea. I'm going to build this most amazing piece of software. I know everything there is to know about it. So this chart shows you what you think you know. And by the time you ship version 1, so the day you ship version 1, you still are pretty confident. You found a couple of things maybe that, you know, I'm not sure about, but you're 98%. You're 9.8 out of 10. In terms of how well you think you know your topic and you know about your product and you know what needs to get delivered. Of course, once you ship that and you start getting early adopters, you discover very quickly that you don't know as much as you thought you knew, but you're still pretty confident because people are actually buying your product or using your product and you're like, oh, I must be pretty smart, someone's using it. Actually, when you get to version 2 and ship version 2, you're starting to get more people using it because a lot of people don't buy version 1, they wait till version 2. And then you work out that actually maybe you didn't know as much as you thought you knew. So your level of confidence goes down a little bit. Remember, this is what you think you know. You get to version 3, you're kind of at the bottom of where you think you know. You've actually discovered a whole bunch of things that you don't know about your product, and you don't know about the people that use your product, and you don't know about how they use your product. And so you're starting to get a bit smarter. And then 3.1, which is always the best version of everything, remember, is the version that you start to go uphill in terms of how your confidence goes and how you feel about the product. Until the product is retired and you no longer use the product, and then you become a freaking genius. Because hindsight is 20/20. So, you know, that's kind of interesting, but let's compare that to what you actually know. So when you start off on a new project, you think you're this genius, but actually there is this heap of information that you have no idea about how people are going to use the product. You have no idea about what people are going to use the product for. You know, spreadsheets, they're for making lists, right? And databases. Nobody thought about that when Dan Brinklin first started building spreadsheets. He didn't think, oh, someone's going to use this as a list tool. So you don't really understand very much about how people will end up using your product. And so I've given you the benefit of the doubt. You understand, you know, just above zero. And then as version one ships, you actually start to learn stuff. What you actually know starts increasing over time as you get product out the door, which is great. And, you know, this helps you. You get to that version 3 and version 3.1. You really are starting to know a whole bunch. The reality is that when a product is retired, while you think you know everything, you actually don't. And the reason the product is retired is because you screwed up somewhere. Because if the product kept going, it would mean you were going onwards and learning more about how people are using it. But someone else has eaten your lunch at that point. So it's too late. So then that's what you think you know compared to what you actually know. What can you do about it? Well, what you can do about it is a little bit less than your ability to know about things, because you can't action on everything. Like, I'm sure all of you that have shipped software, how many people have shipped software, by the way? Okay, good. That helps. All of you that have shipped software have shipped a product, and you go, you know what? It's good, but if it did this, it would be better. And you know that, but you just haven't had time to do it, right? You know that there are bugs still in the system. They're like, won't fix bugs, unresolvable, don't care. Only one person in the universe needs to use that feature. It's not going to happen. But it could be better, and you know that. And so the real trick in my mind, the activity that we should be undertaking as software developers is thinking about how do we get to those higher points of what we actually know and what we can actually action on faster. And that's really the point of this talk, is how can we learn more faster? How can we compress time? That's really what we want to do. We want to work out, how can I get to version 3.1 super quick? And there are some tricks that you can use. Some of them involve working 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, but not all of them. That's not always beneficial. It will help you compress time to some degree. Time is a weird thing anyway. Anyone that's been in the flow of programming knows you can be writing some code and hacking away at stuff and getting stuff done, and you think, you know, wow, I've done a ton of stuff, and you look up and it's like 5 minutes later than when you started, and you did like all these things in 5 minutes. And then at other times you can be dealing with some issue and you're challenged with it and you're stuck there, and you look up and everyone's gone home and it's 10 p.m. and you thought it would only take you 10 minutes. So time is a bit of a weird thing. How many people here are using Kanban, out of interest? Okay, a few of you. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about Kanban, because I said when I talk about Agile, and you know, my background is Agile. Kind of one of my things I did was bring extreme programming to Australia in 2000, and you know, I do like the Agile principles. But I'm not religious about it, you know, and I do have challenges with people say, oh, you can't be Scrum unless you do this, 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 and this, and tick all the boxes. But what, you know, what Kanban does bring that I think is really valuable is this concept of limited WIP. How many people have heard of limited WIP? Okay, so limited work in progress. Now, the great thing about this is it reduces the amount of things you have to deal with at any one point in time. And this is really valuable, because by reducing your current amount of work in progress, you have an ability to deliver quicker. So let's take a step back a little bit before I dig more into this and think about when you're ready to ship. Because remember, the quicker you ship, the quicker you learn things. So when are you ready to ship? You should be ready to ship every day. Now, some people are getting to this point, but it's a hard point to get to. And so what I want to talk about when I talk about limited WIP is how you get to a place where you can ship every day. So most of you, you might not call it a backlog, but you have some kind of list of stuff that needs to get done, right? It's your scope, it's your iteration deliverable, it's your work to do. It's your task list, it's the features that need to get delivered until this, you know, before this product is ready to ship or next version is ready to ship. Call it a backlog if you want to be kind of Scrum, Agile kind of person, but call it whatever you want, doesn't really matter. It's a list of stuff to do. And then you have work in progress. This is the stuff you're actually working on. And then you have done stuff. And done stuff should be ready to ship. So this is what happens. You have your list of items here, and you say, okay, I'm going to start on item one. And you start working on item one, and then, wait a minute, I'm blocked on this, so I'm going to start on item two. And then you get blocked on that, and so then you start on item three, and you're blocked on that, and then you do four, and you ship four. But wait a minute, now my product and the state of my product is kind of, well, I've got these three items that are not quite finished yet. Can I ship with this half-written stuff in there? And this is one of the things that delays products, is things not being quite finished. They're almost finished, but they're not quite finished. And so if you can limit the work you have in that work in progress column, if you can limit what's in there and say, look, stuff in here is either being worked on, being pulled out and pushed back into the backlog, or delivered. Don't leave it in the, oh, it's kind of started. Now, when you talk, when people who do Kanban talk about limited WIP, they try and work out how much work in progress can we actually deal with. Now, Kanban's background is it comes from Lean, and it comes from the idea of, you know, I guess more traditional manufacturing is its history. And so, you know, you have factory lines that things get blocked on, and you don't want to have backlogs of items that are waiting to get processed within a specific line. And so you limit the total amount of work in progress so that there's a continual flow and that the flow is faster. Well, in many ways, that's what you want to do in software. You want that flow to continue. And what you want to do is get to a point where you can work on something, move it into here, have it finished and ready for delivery, and then work on the next thing. Now, of course, most of us are probably not one person or two people. We're probably part of a bigger team. And so the work in progress is probably going to be a few items as different people are working on different things. So I'll talk a little bit about how we address that as well. And the way we're going to do the rest of this presentation is by following the idea of limited WIP. And the whole presentation is really going to be a demo of limiting what is not finished. And I'm going to talk about these items. I don't know if we're going to get through them all, but you're my customers, and I'm time boxing each one to 5 minutes. They're numbered 1 to 10, and I will pick any one that I hear shouted out the loudest to start talking about, and we'll time box it to 5 minutes. Which number?
Number one?
Okay, we'll talk about number one. So I'm going to time box number one, continuous integration, and we'll time box it to 5 minute conversation, and then we'll move on to the next one. So, number one, continuous integration, work in progress. Whoops, don't want to do that. One less timer, there we go. Okay, so continuous integration. How many people here think they have a continuous integration box? Okay. More people putting their hands up as they think about it. Do we? Is it? I don't know. What have we got? So there's some box that does builds. I don't know. So continuous integration is partly about having a box that does builds, but it's about a whole bunch of other things too. So let's think about what the ideal, if you want to ship really quickly, what is that continuous integration story going to look like? Well, it should, as soon as anyone commits code into your repository, source control system, whatever you use. I don't want to have this conversation, right? So I'm just going to assume everyone uses source control of some nature. So whether it's Git or Subversion or some archaic source depot or whatever, I don't care. But you have something. So as soon as code gets committed, your continuous integration magical thing should get that code and build it. And then it should do a bunch of other things as well to make it ready to ship or tell you whether it's ready to ship or not. So what are those other things that it should do? Well, the first thing it should do is it should run automated tests, which is actually another topic, so I'm not going to talk too much about that. But it should validate As part of the continuous integration process, you should validate that the code you're building is good code. You know, what continuous integration should get rid of is the "it works on my machine" problem, right? It should be something that pulls everyone's different commits and different code that's being written, compiles it all together, gets it ready to ship. So that's another part of it, gets it ready to ship. What does that mean? Well, it could mean different things. If you're building a website, it could be push it all the way through to staging. Some companies have continuous integration servers that actually push it live, straight away. That's how much we trust our developers, that they'll build tests and they'll do the right thing so that as soon as code is committed into our source control system and it builds and passes whatever automated tests we have in there, we're going to push it live. And there are some pretty big companies doing that. If you are going to do that, I would say you need a way of being able to roll back fast too. So that's something else. If you're building your continuous integration to go all the way to push into live environments, which is a viable thing to do nowadays, you need a way of pushing a button that takes it back out again as well. So what else about continuous integration is interesting? Well, if you are building not a web app, so a client app, a phone app, the Windows app, your continuous integration machine should spit out an installer ready to go, or a package ready to be pushed up to the store. Or if you feel real brave, push it to the store. Why not? Well, because store will probably come down and kill you, but you pushed 17 builds to the store today. What's wrong with you guys? It's not your problem, really, it's their problem. But you know, they have to then go through and but you know, I know some people that are trying to do that, and it's interesting because if you think about the end goal of being able to of making software really flexible and being able to push software really fast and push bug, you know, kill bugs and get solutions out, get new features out really quickly into devices, why not have a system that enables you to push directly out to those devices? Now, if you're within an enterprise situation, it is quite possible that you can do that. You don't have a store in between you and your customers or your users. It is quite possible that you could get a continuous integration with client applications pushing directly out to those devices. And there are a number of companies that are doing that, which means you can end up with multiple updates a day, or the device will only pull one a day. You can limit it on device side or on management side, but those updates might be available and continue to be available throughout the day, new builds, new updates. And what's interesting to me is that huge companies now, like platform companies like Google and Microsoft, are doing this with massive pieces of software, right? Like Windows. So, you know, if anyone comes to me and says, oh, my software is like too complicated and too big to do continuous integration, I will call bullshit on that. Because if you can do it with Windows, you can do it with pretty much anything. That's 5 minutes I've shipped. Okay, knowing when to stop, that's a good one. Knowing when to stop. So what's the problem we're trying to solve here? The problem is we're trying to ship something. So when do you know you're ready to ship? Well, you know, I'm going to be brutal here and say always, right? But when do you stop and actually say, okay, this is a release that's, you know, I'm going to label version 1, or I'm going to label version 2, or I'm going to label, you know, version 2.1. This is a really interesting question, and I'm not sure that it's even relevant anymore. So I'm not sure how many people have picked up on this, but Microsoft has made a statement. Windows 10 is the last version of Windows. Now, some people have gone, oh, that means Microsoft's not doing Windows anymore. Well, that's obviously, you know, to put it bluntly, retarded, right? That's not going to happen. What it means is that versioning doesn't make sense anymore. calling something version 1, version 2, version 3, if you have continuous integration cycles and you are able to push updates in a really rapid way, doesn't necessarily make sense anymore. So it doesn't really answer the question, though, of knowing when to stop. When do you actually say, okay, this is good? Well, first thing is, hopefully, you've got all your cycles in place, all your automation stuff in place so that you can have your continuous integration. You know that you've got a valid build that's good. It passes all your tests. Hopefully, you've written billions of tests, and it's super awesome. But the reality is you probably haven't. You've probably written some tests if you're lucky. So then you get it into customers' hands. So if you're smart, you would probably have some preview customers, or what Microsoft is calling insider builds. How many people here are on insider builds for Windows or phone? So a bunch of you, you know, you're geeks, you love this stuff, you're getting into early builds, and you accept the penalty that, hey, stuff might not work, but you want to play with it. Well, you probably have customers like that too. You probably will find within your organization, within your customer base, there are people that are willing to be guinea pigs, willing to, as Steve Ballmer used to call it, dog food your products, and they will provide feedback, and that's another topic, that will help you know when you're ready to actually go. Because once you stop hearing complaints, you know you're in a quite a good place. So then you can start thinking, all right, maybe we should call this version 1, or version 2, or version next. But I would say one thing you should think about when you are talking about knowing when to stop and knowing when to deliver is you should talk to your stakeholder, which could be your customer, it could be the person who's paying you, is often a good person to speak to, and find out what are their minimum must-haves before they consider the product ready to go. Because, you know, you can keep doing a ton of stuff forever and ever and ever. Now, this is often a really hard conversation because some customers are quite good about it, and they're like, yeah, I must have 1, 2, 3, and if I had that, at least I could move forward. But some customers are like, yes, here's my list. I've got to have all these things, including the purple widgy-wodgy thing that no one even knows what it is and no one spec'd it yet. So with those guys, you have to sit down with them and say, look, the reality is you're not going to get all of that until probably 23rd century. So if we focus a little bit and bring it down to a real world, like what, you know, say, you know, we want to deliver something in the next month or two, what would be your core things? And you need to have that hard conversation. And once you've got that conversation underway, generally people are pretty smart. They work it out and they're like, okay, what is the real core of what makes this product of some business value? Now, not always can you get to that place. And so then you have to pull back again and say, okay, you know, you've given me this project, I'm going to ship it in 2025, but if I could deliver one thing for you out of all of this, what would it be? And then they start thinking a little bit harder. And so if you can't get a sensible answer out of them, get them down to one. Get them down to one feature that they really care about and go, okay, which is the most important feature in this product? That's the one I'm going to work on. That's the one I'm going to pull back and focus on. That'll be my broken down to a set of work in progress tasks, and once that's done, I'm going to ship. So knowing when to stop is a hard thing that's, I think, a shifting boundary now over the coming years as we go away from this concept of version numbers into this more continued flow of software updates that come into our products. Shipped. Number 3. What's number 3? Code reviews. Oh, I love this one. Okay. How many people here do code reviews? Wow, quite a few of you. I'm impressed. Nearly half. So you're reviewing everyone else's code, right? So half of you are doing code reviews, the other are just writing code. This is actually, you know, you shouldn't laugh, because this is kind of what tends to happen in larger organizations and larger development teams, is that there will be some people who are really, like, passionate about doing code reviews, and there are some people who will avoid it like as though it's the plague. I actually think code reviews are incredibly valuable. So let's talk about why they're valuable first, and then how do you maybe trigger some of that behavior to happen. So the most important thing about code reviews is you start looking at other people's code and learning how they write software. Now, sometimes that's amazing because you thought you were the smartest guy in the development team, but wait a minute, this guy's doing some cool stuff. I didn't know you could do that in C sharp. Wow, that's cool. So you might actually learn something yourself. That's a great way of learning things, is from your teammates by looking at their code. Second thing is, a second set of eyes is always, always going to help. You will spot things. You know when you're writing code and you're right in the depth of it and you've got 18 things going on in your mind and your wife is calling you and your girlfriend is calling you and you're trying to work out what you're going to do for dinner tonight with the kids. This is a problem, right? So you write some code that's not quite optimal. Someone else coming and looking at that code is going to be helpful and reviewing it and giving you some feedback. This helps with not just the details at the micro level of the code. So, you know, have you got, you know, are you doing exception handling well? Are you, you know, validating, you know, checking for nulls, all that kind of good stuff. But also at a macro level of the structure of the code. Because when you're in the details of writing some function, some algorithm, you often forget about kind of the structure and how the whole thing hangs together. The other great thing about code reviews is you start sharing. And so as a team, you start going, well, this is just like that thing that I wrote yesterday. Why aren't you calling my function? That was tested. So you start getting this ability to maybe reduce the total amount of code, which is good, and share that. The other thing that code reviews promote heavily, and some of you may already have this, but is a coding standard. How many people have coding standards, right? Do you use underscores? Do you use camel case? Do you use, I don't care where your curly braces go, blah, blah, blah. If you code review, you kind of by default end up in a position where you're forced to have coding standards. Because then it's easier to code review. It's easier to read other people's code if it's this, you know, written with the same kind of format and structure as your code. The other thing that code reviews do that is critical to helping you ship faster, which is the whole point of this conversation, is that they take away blocks when one person is out of the office, no one can work on that particular piece of code because John knows it and he worked on it and no one touches it. But if you had all code reviewed it, you would know it, right? And so you would feel more comfortable getting into it. If someone finds a bug in a piece of code, well, it's not John's code anymore. It becomes a shared entity. Code that's reviewed by multiple people as well. So code review is not necessarily just I write some code, one other guy reviews it, and it gets done. Code reviews can be an ongoing process where code can be reviewed multiple times. And the advantage of doing that is then you get massive shared ownership of that code. Because, okay, someone wrote it to start with, but now by the time it's been reviewed and updated and people have found different issues with it, it's now it belongs to multiple people. Multiple people have contributed to it. And this means the ownership of that area of code is no longer John's code. It's now Neil's code and Adam's code and Greg's code and, you know, it's a ton of people's code because we've all added to it. And so code reviews really help with that. And then reduce your limitation of saying, I can't get anyone to work on that part of the project right now, because everyone should know about it. So it creates a shared knowledge of the code that's being built within the system. And so code reviews are a great way of sharing that. Now, I actually would promote real-time code reviews as well, which is sometimes called pair programming. Now, some people think pair programming is two people sitting on their own laptop next to each other. That's not pair programming. Pair programming is two people, sometimes three, try programming. Lots of people try programming, not everyone's good at it. Pair programming, two people, same screen, one keyboard, one mouse, working together on the same problem. Okay, shipped. Feedback loops, okay. Let's talk about feedback loops. Actually, everything we're talking about is feedback loops. So I could almost just finish that one there and ship it early. But feedback loops are kind of the most important thing that you ever do in software. And in fact, every piece of software you ever build, in many regards, is a feedback loop in itself. And you start thinking about that, you start, okay, your brain starts going a little squiggly. But the reality is that is true. you're building something, whether it spits out on a web page or it's you know, running an algorithm that spits something into a database or whatever it is you're doing, that is a feedback loop of some sort, because you're going and checking it and seeing, is it doing the right thing? It's giving you feedback, this ones and zeros that are, you know, moving bits around inside the computer are somehow giving you output, and that output is feedback. What you want to do if you want to ship faster is have more. So what do I mean by more? Well, I mean more in terms of a set of, you could think of them as concentric circles, or you could think of them as a spiral that just goes on and on and on forever. And at the micro level, those feedback loops, things we were just talking about, like code reviews, or you know, are giving you feedback into the team, developers talking to developers. And this is really important, providing feedback in the team to help you go faster, to help you build better code, to help you build more structured code, to help you understand each other's problems and help each other go faster. Feedback loops can happen, you know, on a minute-by-minute basis with your code if you have automated tests and you have a continuous integration and build machine. Every time you commit, and you know, if anyone you know, is still in the old school of, oh well, I wrote code for 2 weeks and then I committed it, you know, you can leave now, because the reality is, the modern world, people are committing, you know, multiple times, sometimes multiple times an hour, but certainly multiple times a day into their source control. There's a continual flow. And the faster you commit, the faster you get feedback from, you know, if you have a dashboard or some way of knowing whether the build has succeeded, some way of knowing whether the tests have passed. That's very micro-level feedback. Then take it up a level. How many people here are like doing stand-up or scrum-type meetings, right? That's feedback loops. That's providing progress reports on a daily basis, a feedback between yourselves as developers, but also with your customers or your stakeholders if they happen to attend, which is quite nice if they do, because they're paying for it, so that's kind of cool. But that's a feedback loop in itself. And one of the things I notice in some of those kind of environments is that often people will go, okay, I'm waiting for everyone else to finish. Okay, now what I did, and then they disengage again. And this doesn't help you, because you're not getting the feedback then. One of the best ways to do those kind of engagements or have a stand-up or regular daily meeting is to really engage. If you want to move faster, if you want your team to ship faster, you have to understand what everyone else on your team is doing, and they have to listen to you and understand and respect what you're doing, and you will go faster. So let's take feedback loops up another level. Let's take them up to those early stage customers and those early adopters that you've got out there that are starting to use product, or internal customers that are starting to use your product. That's a whole other feedback loop. Do you have mechanisms to support that? Do you have mechanisms to get that feedback and implement it back into your system and add it to your backlog? Do you have mechanisms that enable your early stage users to actually make a difference to the product? Because if you don't, there's no point in giving it to them. There's nothing worse for a user to give a big report and someone says, yeah, I wrote all that down. And you know full well that means they wrote it all down and filed it over there somewhere. So getting that feedback loop is important. And then the big feedback loop that happens is when you actually start shipping to the real world and customers, and that's what actually gives you that knowledge increase on that graph that goes up, because that's a feedback loop. That's feedback coming back into your system, into your overall developer environment, telling you what's working, what's not working. Wow, they're using this product how? And I'm sure many of you have had that experience where you've built a product and you never thought that people would use it that way. It never even occurred to you that someone might use it that way. And now they're doing this and you're like, okay, I need to think about adjusting. They're paying more than anyone else. I need to think about adjusting the direction of this product, or how we support that, or what we do for those guys. All of that is feedback loops. And you need to think about how you are structured about your feedback loops. I'm going over time, delivering late. How you're structured about your feedback loops and making sure that that information is getting back into your system so you can actually action on it. Number two, automated testing. How many people are doing automated testing? Not as many as I'd like. Okay, I have to convince the rest of you now. I've got 5 minutes. So I guess the first thing to know about automated testing is it's really the fastest way of getting that feedback. So, you know, your order of picking these out is just fantastic. It's the fastest way of getting that feedback into your system on a micro level is to have automated testing, because those tests that are running every time a build is made on your continuous integration server, on your build server, is giving you immediate feedback as to the quality of your product. Well, actually, it's not. I tell a lie. It's giving you immediate feedback as to the quality of your tests. So what you test is really the question, and of course the answer is everything. Okay, but I don't have an infinite amount of time. Okay, so you work on testing the things that you know are likely to be problems. Well, wait a minute. You wrote the code to know that this is a problem now. So I've written this code. Now I'm going to write some tests to validate it, but I wrote the code, so I already know how it works. So I'm writing tests. So actually, let's turn that around. So the best tests you ever write are the tests you build before you write the code. Your tests should identify the scope of your code. And in fact, the most powerful testing you can ever build, the most powerful automated tests, are test-driven, using test-driven processes. So you build tests, and then you build code to make the test pass. And then you build more tests, and you build more code to make the test pass. And it's the code that you ship, not the tests. But those tests are giving you a head start in enabling you to move faster, because they are scoping your endpoint. They're scoping your knowing when to stop point. So that's one level of developer testing, if you like, where you're building out your tests. As I say, recommend you do it first, and then you build your code. The great thing about automated tests is you can actually run them locally most of the time too, or a subset of them if you're building a humongous system, locally, and validate that what you're about to commit is not going to break the build server. So you can say, oh, this piece here, I haven't touched it, it won't break, so because I've changed a bunch of stuff here. How do you know that? Well, you know that because you ran tests, and those tests for that piece there are still going, and they're still working, so nothing broke over there. What automated testing does for you at this point is it gives you flexibility within your software. One of the biggest problems we have in software development as projects grow and get bigger is what I call brittle software. As software grows, it becomes harder to maintain because every little change you make is somehow connected to something else, and then I change one thing here and this thing here breaks and I didn't even know they were connected. How did that happen? If you had tests, you would know straight away that this thing here had broken, if there were tests around it. So the tests reduce the brittleness. The other thing they do is they identify the brittle areas for you to focus on changing early on. So you can take those areas that have broken when you make a change and go, oh, why did that break when I changed this class here? This shouldn't have anything to do with it. But it does. So now I try and work out where is the connection here. So it's giving you early stage identification of your areas of brittleness so you can address them and build more flexible code going forward. So that's test-driven and unit tests. What about other kinds of tests that you can automate? Absolutely you can. You should be able to automate nowadays user interface testing. And a lot of that is very possible, both on web and on client now, with the set of tools that are out there. You know, go see your friendly vendor. And you can automate, you can build scripts that will automate customers, pretend customers going through and using your product. And that is very powerful too, because you run those and you find out things that you wouldn't know about just by running your code tests. They're things that, you know, different ways that people are using the product that you can automate. You can also take that up a level as we start to scale product and think about scale testing or long-term testing. So one, you know, some of the teams that I've worked with recently are doing things where they have a set of servers that are just pushing the boundaries of the products over long periods of time. Let's have this app up and running for, you know, 150 hours nonstop, pushing data in and taking data out and, you know, doing cool things with it. And that is a whole other set of testing. So Automated testing. I'm going to ship that. Hate communication. Okay. Well, we've talked a lot of things that are really about communication, and feedback loops are kind of useless unless you have some way of communicating them. So let's again take this as a set of concentric circles all the way from developers talking to each other, which I know we hate to do, but we should do it occasionally, like at least once a day, up to communication with customers. So communication at a developer-to-developer level, I think, is something that we hugely underestimate. You know, and especially you see this a lot in companies where people are like, oh, no, you know, our developers, they all sit in little cubicles and they don't talk to each other, and that's just great because they're getting code written. Actually, no, it's probably the worst thing you could do. So I encourage developers to be in an open space, working with each other, talking to each other. There's a certain kind of developer likes to do that. Everyone's a little bit different, and most people don't like to talk all day, every day. Like, you want some headspace where you're just going and trying some stuff out, doing some stuff, and then you want to come back and work with someone and stuff. Pair programming does help there as well, because it's creating a communication layer between developers that is more structured. You're focused on solving a task, you do it together, you pair on it, and you solve stuff. Communication, taking that up a layer, when you think about like daily meetings and things like that, is important. But actually, within the environment every day, how many people have like big dashboards in their environment that tell them where they are at? Yeah, a few of you. This is actually, and it's getting so cheap now to buy like a big TV screen and stick it on the wall and plug a computer into it and have dashboards that are running all day, every day, telling you the health of your system, telling you things like the number of builds that have happened, the number of commits that are happening, having your burndown charts, having, you know, real-time information being displayed within your development environment, because, you know, you want to work at NASA really, but you didn't get that job. So you put those big screens up because it looks cool. But actually, there's valuable information on those big screens, and that's what you want to be having, is publicly displayed within your development environment, that valuable information that's telling you the current health. It's communicating the current health of your system back to you. So that's a communication protocol, if you like. Now, actually, this is, when we talk about communication, I should talk about communication protocols, because it is one of the hardest things to do is tell someone that their code sucks, right? And so, you know, when I talk about code reviews, I should have talked about this, but I'll talk about it as part of the communication piece. So when you give people feedback, when you communicate with someone, one of the big challenges we have as developers is that each and every one of us is the smartest person in the room. Even in this room, there is, I don't know how many people, 70 people, whatever, you're all the smartest person in this room, right? We've already had that conversation. But so when I look at your code and I think, oh, wow, this sucks, how do I tell you that, right? How do I give you that information without making you think like, wow, this guy's a dick, right? Well, you need to flip it around. And so what you need to do is start thinking about, how would I improve it? So the best communication you can give at that point is, you know what? I could improve that code. Let me help you improve it. If you did this, 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 and this, and give them positive actions that they can take to make the code better. So as part of communication, you should keep, the conversation should always be positive. The conversation should always be about, what are the things that can be actioned on that will improve? And that way, especially when you're talking to creative people, which we are all, if we're developers, we're probably fairly creative. That's what we do. We like building stuff, cool stuff. Is you're not insulting their product. Because that code I wrote is my product. Don't insult it. But you're going to help me make it better. Oh, cool. Okay. I'll take that. So flip that conversation around. So when you talk about communication, when I talk about communication, I talk about how do you change the conversation to be a positive conversation with managers, with developers. How do I make sure that it's always about positive actions that can be taken? When you have a meeting, with whether it's with your customers, whether it's with developers, that meeting is totally useless if at the end of it you don't have positive actions that can be taken. You've just wasted however long that meeting was. You have to have a bunch of positive actions that can be taken as an output of a meeting. Very little time left on this topic, but communication with customers is critical to increasing your ship speed, because the more you know, the better you go, the faster you can get there. And so getting that communication channel open with your early stage customers, getting feedback into your system through communication channels with your customers is also critical. And there's another topic here which I will talk a little bit about that. But just quickly, one of the things I would say is think about how in your software you can build communication back to the customer. And some software's already doing this, right? It's asking you, how do you like my software? Can you rate me? Can you give me feedback? Do it within the actual product.
Number four,
customer feedback. Oh, look, you guys are just picking them, so this leads so perfectly in from the next one. Okay, great. So, yeah, let's talk about customer feedback. So, let's finish that conversation. Within your software, whether it's a web page, an app, a mobile app, a delivery, build a system into that that lets the customer enter information about their product, about your product, about how they're using it. Give you feedback directly within the app. Why should they leave the app? Well, there's one place where this is a problem. So that's a great idea, except for that guy that writes you the email. I'd love to give you feedback in your app, except your app keeps crashing. So actually, you know what would be really cool? Would be to know that that guy's app is crashing before he does, or before he can send that email. And you can do that. So you can, and this is another topic, is about building statistics into the system, but you can build into the system, you can build customer feedback into the system that's automated. Now, a lot of countries, everyone has different laws and rules, but a lot of countries require that they opt in to that kind of monitoring. Oh, you know, you're monitoring how I'm working, you know. But it is really, really valuable. How many people here have products that use customer focus groups? No one. Oh, my God. Okay. Now, maybe you do, but it's the marketing guys or sales guys that are doing it, and you're just sitting there totally ignorant as to where these product requests, feature requests come from. But so one of the really valuable things you can do with customers is to ask them, is to get them in a room together. You know, one of the best things you can ever do is find a handful of customers that are using your product that don't know each other yet and get them in a room together. You want to hear bitching? You'll hear bitching. Right? This is great because this is telling you really important, valuable information about what they love about the product. You know, the reality is if they're going to turn up in the first place to a feedback forum or to a feedback review or a customer review type space, they probably quite like your product, right? They probably want to use it more. They're probably already your friend. So if your friend starts telling you that you need to do something about your hair, maybe it's time to start doing something about your hair, right? Maybe if your friends are telling you that shirt doesn't suit you, maybe it's time to do something about that. And so getting that that feedback from your customers is what's going to enable you, again, to go up that chart in terms of what you actually know getting greater. When you actually discover that your product is being used for something you never considered before, that changes your mind about how you're going to, you know, continue supporting that product, building that product, deploying that product. You know, you find some really interesting things from customers. Like they don't like the way that they get updates or they don't like the way they get upgrades. These are things that are usually, you know, not considered until the end, but they could be really important in terms of the way your customers feel about your product. Sometimes it's the little things that make a huge difference. And as developers, you're like, it's like half a day's work, I could fix that. And suddenly your customer satisfaction goes through the roof. And so those kind of things are really important to find out as well. So how do you filter that? Now, if you're not running customer forums or feedback or having some way of doing it, someone maybe is within your organization. So how do you get that information back into your development backlog so you can actually do something about it? One of the things I've started thinking about doing and some of the groups I'm working with are doing is within the backlog, they have a number of different items, right? I'm sure you have seen this within your task list or whatever. And they're somehow using a mechanism to highlight. So maybe it's a different color, or they've put a letter next to it, or it's got, you know, a
an underscore in front of it or something, but it means this has come from a customer. This is not some crazy dude sitting in product management going, oh, wouldn't it be cool if it was... This is actually a customer asking for a feature or asking for a change. And so identifying that within your working, within your work to-do list or within your backlog can be very valuable, because those are the things that really are going to make a difference to customers. If you are, in fact, how many people here have the ability to make decisions as to what gets done next in the backlog, like can actually help prioritize things? Wow, okay, great. So you guys can actually help prioritize and differentiate between what gets done. So what's important is to understand what customers are doing, what end users are doing with your product. Because how on earth can you make a decision as to what gets done next if you don't know how customers are actually using your product? So customer feedback, really critical, I think, to being able to move faster and keep that trajectory going up of what you actually know. Okay, where are we up to?
Statistics.
Okay, nice. I should have rubbed these out. What have I done? Code reviews, continuous integration. We've done automated testing, knowing when to ship. We've done communication. We've done feedback loops. Okay, statistics. Start. Okay, so statistics. This is, again, continuation of maybe the prior conversation, but being able to track the usage of your products, the usage of your software, is incredibly valuable. How many people here can tell me how many times their product has been run in a day? Okay, you guys are doing great. This is a great step forward. How many people here can tell me how many times their apps have crashed in a day? Okay, that's good too. How many people here can tell me how many different users log on to the same PC for the same app? Yeah. You can dig into this forever, but there's lots of different types, and it depends on your product, right? So different products require different types of statistics. But being able to generate usage scenarios from the statistics is really, really important. So it's not just has it run, but what are they actually doing in it? And can I track that? And can I get, you know, in fact, if you're smart about it, you start thinking, wait a minute, I'm tracking, I've got all these stats as to what people are doing with the product. Could I convert those into automated tests? Could I take that information and build a set of tests? Oh, a very common scenario is someone does this, this, and this with the product. You know, they launch the app or they go to the website, they do these five tasks, and then they shut down. Well, that should be an automated test, right? If that's what's happening by a bunch of people, that's the kind of stuff that you want to automate. Because if you've got a big customer base doing this every day with your product, that's the one thing you don't want going wrong. So getting that statistics in, how many people here are using tools like Crashlytics or Intune? There's a ton of them, right? So there's now a ton of third-party products that you can just plug into your system too. If you're building apps or you're building websites, Microsoft has them in cloud, tons of third-party ones too that you can plug into, and they'll start giving you a bunch of information. But it's usually fairly generic, and it will give you good things like crash logs, which are really important. But you want to have other information too. So you want to start thinking about the boundary conditions of your software and building into your software, building into your application, into your website, the ability to report the details of what's being used. Okay, that's great. Now I've got this reporting system, and it's giving me all this data into my servers, and someone's asking me why I'm spending all this money on server data storage. What are you going to do with it? Well, now you need to, there's no point in collecting it all until you start analyzing it, and you start actually doing something with it. So being able to start running reports, even if it's as simple to start with as saying every week how many people have used my app, every day how many people have used my app, that's a starting point. But from then you want to start doing, well, okay, how many crashes, how many runs, how, you know, are people, you know, what's the scenario? Are people running my app 17 times a day? One person runs it. So why are they doing that? What's going on? Why are they not just run it once and leave it running? And start finding out those kind of details. So being able to attach metadata, you don't necessarily want PI because that leads to a whole bunch of other problems, personal information. You don't want to know that it's Bob that launched the app 17 times. But person A has launched the app 17 times in a day is kind of valuable. And how many of the people are taking that path. So being able to get that kind of stats into your system is critical. It also will give you much more information about how you should focus your energy in order to get that next ship update version, whatever you want to call it, out. Because if you're starting to see behavioral patterns, it will start to adjust your priority within your backlog. It'll start to adjust the way that you're interacting with your customers too, potentially. You're starting to see that there's a ton of people that are going a very convoluted way around getting something to work. And yet there's some menu somewhere that would just do it with one click, but they obviously don't know about it. So maybe it's time to send out a newsletter to all your customers or all your users saying, hey, did you know you can do this? So this is other interesting information that gives you increased customer satisfaction, but also maybe you should think, why don't they find that button? Why don't they find that menu item? So now you adjust your software because you're a little bit smarter now, one more thing you knew, so that you adjust your software in the next version so that it's, you know, getting closer to that better product, the ultimate product. That's pretty much it. I'm going to ship that one. Certifications. Ah, this is a bitching one. Okay. How many people here have certifications in something? Yeah, I do too. Yeah. Absolute waste of my time. But anyway. There's one certification that really counts when it comes to shipping software, and that's a history of shipping software. There are a billion, I don't know, I haven't counted, it's probably not quite a billion, it's probably just two under or something, but certifications that you seem to be able to get in different types of software development, project management, agile, you know, scrum masters, whatever. Going and doing a two-day course on how to ship software is, in my mind, just hysterical, right? It's like, how on earth does this guy come out? He spent 2 days sitting in a room, probably wasn't even listening to what was being said, and he came out and got a certificate saying he's the grand poobah of Doodah. BS. So the reality is that, yes, they help you get jobs. Yes, they help you open some doors, you know, being certified professional, you know, having some stamps on your resumes, on your CVs. It's all good stuff. It shows that you've gone and committed some energy into, you know, your own self-knowledge and into being, you know, hopefully a better person in the environment. But in reality, the best certification is always the history and portfolio of your products that you've worked on and what you've delivered. And that's what you want to really be building on. That's where you really get, you know, when people are looking for someone to join a team, yeah, it's all very well having these certifications, but holy shit, he worked on this, he worked on this, he delivered this, he did this, he did this. That's amazing, right? That's what you want to be thinking about. And that's actually one of the reasons in my mind why shipping faster is even more valuable to us as software developers. Because I'm time-boxed as a human being, right? Okay, it's a little longer than 5 minutes, but I am time boxed, and I need to achieve as much as possible within my lifetime, as quickly as possible, so that I can, you know, people go, oh, wow, I want this guy on my team, because I want to play in the best team, right? As you should. And if you want to play in the best team, if you want to work on the coolest products and on the coolest toys, you're going to have to somehow get into those teams. And the people those teams are hiring are people that have a history of doing cool stuff and delivering. So when you work on products that have a 5-year ship cycle, you've just committed 5-year time box to, you know, that certification, if you like, or to that qualification. If you work on a product that ships 18 versions a year, wow, you know, did this, all this stuff came out of this guy? Wow, that's so cool. He worked on that team. Let's get that guy. So when you think about certifications, you should probably think a little bit about why. Why are you getting those certifications in the first place? The other thing that I think has happened in the last few years, it's the last 10 years really, I'm just getting old, so it feels like a few years, but is that there's been this kind of shift into the agile world, and so everyone's looking for the grand poobah of Baba, and there is no such person. Development teams are valuable because of the whole team. They're valuable because of how everybody interacts. In fact, you know, if you really want to get good usage of time, rather than sending people on certification courses, get them doing something else to embody them better as a team. Get them working together in ways that make them a better team. And this can be anything from, you know, going and doing some fun team building activities through to just having a beer on Friday night together with everyone, right? This is stuff that creates a bonding between the people in the team that gets the team committed and aligned. And actually, that's the most important thing, is to get a team that's aligned to delivering the end result together. Because if it's not, then you end up in situations, well, I think the feature should be like this. No, I think the feature should be like this. Whereas if you're both aligned on it, you'll go, yeah, it should be like this. You'll agree with each other on it. So team alignment is actually more important than certification. But like I say, you will keep going and getting those certifications because they look good on your resumes. But the reality is, whether you're hiring or you're being hired, you need to understand the real value of them is actually pretty limited, and they do not help you. You know, if I go and hire a bunch of people just because they're certified, I don't think I'm going to ship any faster. I'm going to ship faster if I hire people that know how to ship and that have a history of shipping. So that was my bitch on certifications. So what am I down to? Quality assurance? Is that the last one, or did we already talk about that? No, we didn't. And how are we down doing for time? Yeah, we're good. Okay. So quality assurance. Well, we've kind of talked about a lot of that already. People kind of segment it into a different category. It's almost as like, how many people here have testers within their organization? Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? How many people here are testers? Yeah, it's really weird. So it seems like there's still this role of someone whose job it is to go and test the code, but as a developer, you should be able to test the code yourself. And actually, I'm seeing a big shift in very large organizations where by getting in place a bunch of these processes, by getting in place a bunch of the automated testing and unit testing and continuous integration and big dashboards that are giving you the health of your product, customer feedback loops that are very visible. By getting all that stuff in place, testers are almost becoming redundant, which is, you know, maybe another interesting place to be if you're a tester. So if you are a tester and you didn't put your hand up, you become a developer, you're in the right room. I do wonder whether we will have testers as a role. I mean, I actually wonder whether we'll have software developers as a job title in 20 years time, but that's a whole other conversation. But I wonder whether testers are something that's going to disappear over a much shorter time frame. And the reason for that is because as developers, as people building solutions, we are getting smarter about how we do it to reduce our overall defect rate. We are getting smarter about building defensive code. And that's a real, you know, that's a real term. If anyone hasn't heard of it, go and look it up. But building defensive code is a really valuable thing. It's making sure your code is solid so that, you know, testers basically become redundant. Will we ever get to that final point where there are no testers in the world? I doubt it. But we are marching towards it. What's interesting to me is some of the big product groups I've worked with at Microsoft have seen a huge reduction in the total number of people whose role involves QA as their full role. The developers are expected to build high quality code, and if you don't, well, you know where the door is, right? Because we have all the tools to do it now. So quality assurance, let's take that on board, is our job as software developers is to make high quality code. I don't hire anyone to, oh, you know what, I need you to write some bugs so this guy can find them and then this other guy can fix them. that's not the guy that got hired, right? The guy that got hired is the guy that's supposed to write cool code that does amazing things and is, you know, zero defect. So when you consider that, you should think about how do you up the overall level of quality through your everything else that you're doing. And there's a number of ways that I guess we do that every single day through all the different feedback cycles and feedback loops that we've talked about, through the communication loops that we've talked about. Ultimately, though, it doesn't matter, because I've worked on teams that have had, you know, in fact, you know, 20 years ago when I started working with big corporations, some of the companies I worked with, every developer had what was called a testing buddy. So a tester whose full-time job was to test all the output from my, you know, code. In fact, sometimes it was like one test buddy would be shared between two developers or whatever, but that was the way it worked. And that has changed massively over the years. But that output that you're getting out of those quality assurance guys is really just validating what your customer should be telling you, right? So if you're now in this world where you have insider builds, you have early stage previews, do you really need that guy telling you this stuff that you're paying, or do you find people that will do it for free? Because essentially, right, if you're all on insider builds, you are part of Microsoft's QA team for free. Woo-hoo. But that's the reality, right? Early stage builds, betas, Google's been doing it forever, right? And Google never ships anything, right? It's in beta until it's until it's stopped running, right? It's beta and then retired. It's great. Never ship. That's a fantastic mode to be in. But it means that you're constantly using your customers as feedback loops, as testing. So quality assurance changes in the way you get it. So what happens then is if a guy's not sitting inside your firewall or inside, you know, behind the edge, sitting on the other side, you need really good ways of getting that information back in. So if your quality assurance system is now relying on customers, then you've really got to make sure you've got good mechanisms to bring that information back into your system so that you can work on it. Quality assurance shipped. Okay, look what we did. We did a whole bunch of stuff. We shipped a whole bunch of things, which is really cool. And this is what I mean about time boxing. So, you know, a lot of people think, how can I build this software in such a short time frame? It's not possible. I've got to go away and think about it and design it. One of the really interesting things about software that actually is very similar to a lot of other creative product creating disciplines is that you're actually never finished. Right? So to answer the question of knowing when to stop, well, never. Because products are never really finished. Software is never really finished. I had a conversation with an industrial designer who's working on a really cool new product. It's a physical product. And, you know, one of his challenges, oh, yeah, but every time I tweak something, I can realize how I could make it better. And then my stakeholder keeps saying, yes, but we've got to ship this. Damn, I don't want to ship it. I want to keep building. Now, hardware is a lot harder, right? That's why it's called hardware. Because once you go into manufacturing, you kind of have a factory set up that's producing a gazillion of these things every hour or whatever it is. If it's a mouse, maybe it's that high level. If it's a, you know, some other, you know, spaceship or something, maybe it's not that many every year. But it's physically rendered and it's very unflexible. The great thing about software is you can ship and fix, ship and fix, ship and fix, ship and fix. And so should you ever worry about, you know, being time boxed? No, you shouldn't. You should worry about it more in terms of hardware. I totally get that, and I totally get this guy's challenge, but he still has to ship something because he's getting paid, and you know, at some point he has to produce a product. For us as software guys, it's a lot simpler. I really believe that. Software is so flexible. It's like this weird clay stuff that you can manipulate in so many different ways. You can take an existing application that's written one way and you can totally refactor it and manipulate it to be, you know, have a whole different internal structure. No customer would ever be any the wiser. And that's one of the most amazing things to me about software, is just the flexibility within the code that we're building and how quickly we can adjust and how quickly we can manipulate and move. So when I talk about time boxing and I talk about work in progress, I seriously think that we're going towards a next generation of development where we're going to move to a space where we won't just put estimates, but we're going to say, I'm going to spend an hour and a half working on that. I'm going to spend 90 minutes working on that, and it's going to ship. I'm going to time box my development process. And I think we'll start to see more of that kind of activity because, you know what? To get that first, minimum viable product, if you come from that world, or if you've heard of the term minimum viable product, you actually need to get stuff out quickly, and then you need to iterate on it quickly. And so I think we're getting towards a point where the work in progress is going to be time box, similar to how I just did there in that demo. By the way, that was all a demo. No one listens to anything I was saying, did they? Okay. Good. Is actually a real way of starting to think about building software, is actually to start thinking about time boxing stuff. Now, I'm a bit worried because Greg's in here and he's talking next, so I'm concerned that maybe he wants to prep, but we're down to 5 minutes left. So thank you very much for coming and spending some time in this room and hopefully listening to me. I will take questions, but because we're running close on time, what I'll do is we'll go and step outside and take some questions, and then we can walk into the expo area and grab a coffee and carry on talking. So if anyone wants to carry on talking, welcome to, and keep this conversation going. But thank you.